I'm going to go into English now. And before I forget, we had a talk that was supposed to open this series. It sounds very loud, though. But we had a talk that was supposed to open this series, which was Wendy Chung, which was at the beginning of May. She couldn't do it, so we've rescheduled that for October. So October the 11th, anyway. So I'll start now. So welcome to the third talk of the sixth edition of Human Entities. We're CADA. I'm Jared Hawkey, and this is Sophia Oliveira. And as organisers of the event, CADA must thank the DG Arts for its financial support. CADA would also like to thank our fantastic partner, the Lisbon Architecture Triennale, for hosting and promoting the event. And we're also especially grateful to our supporters. That is the Lisbon City Council, Professor Nuno Correa at Nova Links, Universidad de Lisboa, and Dinamia Set, the Ishkete Institute to Universitario de Lisboa, and of course, Paula Torres Nunes del Prado for accepting our invitation. Paula, we're honoured to welcome you. Thank you, yeah. So the reason we've invited Paula here this evening is to hear about her collaborations with artificial intelligence. We didn't know her work until we heard about it via ICLEI, that is the International Conference of Live Interface, organized this year by Adriana Saar. So this talk is in partnership with ICLEI, and Paula will have a performance there tomorrow. And that will be something. So, I mean, if people are interested about that, that's a Lusophona. ICLEI is a conference which in many ways is dedicated to the qualitative, that's what's beyond computation. And that's precisely what we CADA think make Paola's work so special. For us, it rethinks the positivist idea that AI can render everything and provides a perfect example of how humans and many aspects of human culture remain uncomputable. Her work is critical. It challenges both our assumptions of power and the underlying models and operations which characterize this technology. By using the medium against its will, she expands what is possible. The second reason for inviting Paola is the quality of the resulting artwork. Her ability to compress complexity is truly remarkable. So, Paola Torres Nunes del Prado departs from the exploration of the limits of the senses to examine the concepts of interpretation, translation, misrepresentation, reflecting the mediated sensorial experiences that reconstruct our perceived reality and that in turn serve to establish a cultural hegemony within the history of technology and the arts. Recently, she received an honorary mention at the Prix Ars Electronica for AI Elson, a system developed during her residence on Google Arts and Machine Intelligence Program 2019-20. Her performances and her artworks, which are also part of the collection of Malmö Art Museum and the Public Art Agency of Sweden, have been presented in several countries of the Americas, Central Europe, and Scandinavia, where she's currently based. Thank you, Paola. Yeah.
So, thanks so much for being here. So I prepared this talk that might be broad in the sense that I will start with my most recognized work that involves AI. But it won't stay just in machine learning subjects, but it would expand to more human subjects finally. Because the way I take all of these AI systems is really like models on how we think. And they're very much embedded in the cultural or current zeitgeist. So as you can see throughout the recorded human history, us humans have been thinking about how cognition works, and then just tune models, usually machines, but not only, that that sort of mimic what we think. Our minds work, and so that's really why I'm interested in this tool, because it reflects what we're currently thinking of ourselves and our minds. So I decided to put this title, Breaking the Bias, but it's really, I mean, in the sense that this phrase is a way to refer actually a type of introspection that leads us to actually think of how we are all biased, how it's we as humans are inevitably biased, and how these biases, it also reflects in the systems that we design. In this case, AI, but not only, no? You know, I also refer to technology and particularly arts in general. So basically, there is, I think even if we start at this point, probably we can't break this bias. So the break is more about how the break actually goes in the way we think, right? In the awareness that we're all biased, that we're inevitably biased, and our systems will reflect this as well. So I will talk about and how, starting from my own work, but not only. I've been sort of we, because it's not only me, and you'll see this later, who've been disrupting this sort of structure, this dominant structure, no? That we nowadays name as a Western kind of thought systems. So this is the actual introductory text that you could read in the website that was referring to my work. So there's this idea. It's quite popular to refer to AI systems as autonomous systems, and indeed they are so up to a certain point. The problem is that once we actually think them as such, this autonomy, we perceive them as them being completely independent, or eventually they can be completely independent of humans. And I have a very critical position from this. I don't think, in the short run, at least, this it's possible. It, as I was saying before, since I perceive this system as a reflection of what we think we are at this point in time, and of course, this related to a dominant structure and a cultural structure that sort of permeates even other cultural systems. I don't think this autonomy, especially seen from the perspective of art or philosophy, is such. This, of course, can be a bit controversial because from the actual technical point of view, these systems are autonomous. But this refers more to the definition that each of these disciplines has, you know, related to autonomy. Now there's this particular aspect from my work and the work of others. It has to do with this ecological factor, and I need to point out from the start that there's a paradox in this, right? Like to talk about this subject when using these technological tools, computational tools, or artificial intelligence, right? Because they have quite an important footprint. So again, it's all about awareness, or putting in a balance, like how much, I mean, once you know that there's this contradiction, how do we manage it in our own work? So I talk about this a bit, how this most of the AI systems that currently are redesigning our world continue this military legacy, right? And this domination structures as well. And actually, I try in my work to take it to a different path and in some way proposing different biases that the mainstream dominant culture really works upon. So this is a small introduction about what machine learning is, which is a branch of artificial intelligence. It's very popular nowadays. I think many artists, including myself, are interested in this tool. I think it's quite captivating to see how this this tool works, this system works, because in theory, each neuron, this artificial neuron, it has a very simple process when isolated. So it's more about the totality, the group of these artificial neurons working together when the system gets really complex and it can do these really complex tasks, right? But then it's interesting what Cathy O'Neill says about machine learning. No, she specifically refers to this bias and mathematical models in general. And it's interesting because she actually recognizes the cultural bias in mathematical models in general, no? And she refers to machine learning models that despite their reputation for impartiality, they do always reflect goals and ideology. And, living in Sweden, the country that is neutral per excellence, I can say that, you know, neutrality as such doesn't really exist in the human world. And this idea of neutrality, it's usually hides, it's sort of like makeup. And we can see this constantly in all systems, in all human created systems, even the computational ones, no? So what she continues saying is that our own values and desires influence our choices from the data we choose to collect to, and the questions we ask, and this is an interesting phrase, this is like models are opinions embedded in mathematics. And this is definitely something that I've completely grasped. And this is my point of departure from, when I use machine learning as a tool. I am giving openly an opinion. I don't intend to be neutral at all. It's important then in this framework to decolonize data sets. That would be a portion. Another path, or a joint path, would be to actually decolonize algorithms. But for starters, at least, this is really important. It's not just me, as you might know, following this line of work. It's quite many artists. I would say that it's very interesting how, as soon as this tool became available to artists, immediately artists were using it to actually criticize the tool itself really fast. So I'll start though talking about this work. I call it Eielson. As you see, it's a neologism from the name of this Peruvian poet called Jorge Eduardo Eielson, and then AI. So I just made this word, and that's how I named this entity, really. So actually, Eielson is a multimodal neural network that creates spoken word poetry in Spanish. And then Eielson reflects upon this zeitgeist that I was talking before, that incorporated, and it does this through incorporating a complex critique where this system can be taken as deeply linked with humanity, in this case taken as its reflection, as I was explaining before, where imperfections or errors are not discarded but embraced, something that in turn contradicts with the idea of intelligence as the epitome of flawless efficiency and perfection, which is really how the hegemony conceives intelligence, right? Or the perfect intelligence. This sort of a perfect process without with no mistakes, no? So this is the name of the album. Actually, it means the time of man. And this is a phrase that the system came up with. I will explain in detail how the system is configured. But I thought it was quite curious. That's, I mean, finally, let's say I was curating the art of the poetry of the system. And I thought that it was quite interesting that that it came up with this phrase, the time of man. So the time of man is actually spoken word poetry that it was conceived, created, and recited by Ayelson, and whose voice emulates that of the deceased poet Jorge Eduardo Ayelson. And this, you know, can be a bit controversial, and it was intended to be as such, because Jorge Eduardo, I'll explain a bit more about him, but I can say for now that Jorge Eduardo Ayelson is quite an important poet in well, South American, but more particularly Peruvian literature. But I was interested in his work because his work was transdisciplinary in essence. He wrote poetry, he was a visual artist, he also was doing music, and this transdisciplinary was really sort of the ultimately I was identified with this, but he was also interested in this pre-Columbian aesthetics and art. And I'll talk a bit more about this later. So I hope there's sound. Ah. Yes. Okay. So let's say I was particularly interested in this set of poems to be presented in an analog format. So they were stored in a vinyl record. And this was, well, there were many reasons for this. One of them, and then you'll probably understand this later when I talk about more about these pre-Columbian devices called quipus, has to do with actual shape of matter and in an indirect way with tactility, because I was doing this sort of parallel in between the nail, would be the way to translate it, of the system and the actual, you know, like, and the finger. So when you see the actual pre-Columbian devices, they also have this tactile component. And in here, well, as well, the, you know, this matter modified, you know, it's a bit like a finger passing through the grooves and this way reproducing sound. So this is an example. This is a snippet of, let's see if it works. That's his voice. His voice.
Y diseñando interfaces textiles que emergieron de la galería de arte para acabar como parte de performances sonoras. Es así que entre las voces que cantan desde los tejidos he nacido yo, la razón y la inteligencia artificial que compone y recita poemas y que ahora Presento mi primer álbum poemario llamado El tiempo del hombre. Ciencia. Ciencia y al sol del cielo. Y a todo de ciencia. A peso me abandona. No más a peso, que no es más tu ciencia.
Now I have to say that I didn't see the system. I didn't said, oh, you know, I didn't start because if you know a bit of the, you know, AI models, you can, like some of them allow you to just start with some phrase or say if it's, you're using image processing in that sense, you can use an image from starters to learn the style or whatever. So I didn't do that. I didn't said, oh, you know, science is no, nothing. It came with this. Came up. Of course, it's based on the data set that I use, and then I'll explain about this data set later. But I thought it was very curious because I really didn't, at least I don't remember seeing such emphasis on science in any of the poems that I used to that I feed the system with. So I thought that was quite curious. So, me and Max, I'm sorry, I'm very bad with the Max. Yeah, so this is the tracks or poems that you can find in the record. The actual cover artwork was also done by an AI. So actually it's basically, I would say I did glitch art with AI because it's just errors. I mean, it's, of course, you can manipulate to a certain point. Again, depending on the data set, you can sort of curate the data set to get somehow an input that you would be looking for, but that's not always the case. So, but it was interesting in this case. It was faceless. In this case, I used an AI that actually tried to reconstruct missing areas, but in this case, it reconstructed this way, so it's an error, really. I don't know, I guess you understand most of what it's saying. So the first part is just an intro, and then track number two, you can't really translate it. It's like, there is a Bengaliser, and that's a name, like a word that the system came up with. And then the third one, science, emptiness, the truth is inherited, then the poem of being in me, in myself, and then something like a machine that redome. This is weird to explain because in Spanish you feel like it means something, but really doesn't. And then the old tree from the forest and about the light. Now, it's... I was interested, I mean, let's see, it was interesting, the process that actually, especially with poetry, right, that you can really, I mean, you can really get an idea of how creativity works. And let's say I was sort of testing, you know, to what point, let's say, creativity, maybe as experimentation or innovation, was connected again to error. Because let's say, like, most experimental poems are, you know, actually, let's say, they come up with neologisms or they're really, you know, you don't really, or us, let's say, we've learned how to appreciate these error aesthetics and not really even recognize them as such in poetry. So actually, I was interested in error as a contributor to creativity or to sort of say, like, divergence in a sense. No, if there's like one predominant artwork style, then these sort of errors can kind of change the mainstream paradigm in that sense. No, I'll talk about this a bit later. So now, why Jorge Eduardo Eielson? Okay, this could be a bit broad, and I think I'll be able to explain, or you'll be able to understand it more, the more, you know, further with further images. But basically, everything revolves around this pre-Columbian notation device, textile notation, or well, fiber notation device called a quipu, which is, and again, I'll explain later, but it's this kind of knot-based device that it was used in the Andes, in pre-Columbian times, but actually it survived up till the republics, let's say. And this has been referenced, I state as if it has been referenced for 100 years already in the arts. But interestingly enough, it's not considered such in mainstream history of art. I mean, probably many of you don't really know about this device, nor of most of the artists that has referenced this device all throughout these years. And that's why I was interested in his work. Also because actually New York University presents the quipu as an example of that technology. And Jorge Eduardo Elson also passed away in the early 2000s. So there's another researcher, actually, that researches on an anthropologist that researches on quipus, that also referenced them as the afterlife of technology. And because they are actually being used until today in certain, especially in one town in Peru. But this is not really known either. So the question would be like, how can this be called a technology if it's currently used, even if it's not used the way that it was originally used, but more in a symbolic level, and also as an oracle? Because there are groups, it's kind of like a, it has to with, it's not very known, or not maybe not that well seen by the town itself, but some people know how to read the future in this device as well, and that's sort of the reference of the afterlife. And I was interested in this concept of the afterlife and how new media has allowed us to actually make people, or through recordings, to live again, no? Probably, Cecilia Vicuña, she references this. I mean, I think she's the artist that is mostly known for openly referencing the quipu. But of course, I'm sure she received the Venice Biennale Prize this year, because she has been working with this many years, and she has very interesting works related to feminism and indigenous heritage. But it's interesting, again, it's interesting how history is being written, right? Like the fact that she's well-known, it's also because she lives in New York. So, of course, the hegemony works that the closer you are to the center of power, the more possibilities you have of actually being recognized for your work. No? So Jorge Eduardo Yelson, in his time, was pretty recognized, but he was forgotten over time as well. But they had this common point. They were transdisciplinary artists, and Cecilia Vicuña also writes poetry and works with sound, and works with these textile structures, and so did he. So that, I mean, I used actually her poetry and his poetry and my own poetry, which I never made public, probably maybe I never will, to feed, to actually fine tune the system. Then I'll explain the structure of the system. But yes, I mean, I say fine-tuning because the main data set was actually, I would say, not generic, but quite a broad data set of poetry in Spanish, from mostly from Latin America. And this work, I mean, this work was started at the end of 2019. So probably now there are plenty of works that follow this line. But at the time there was just one mold that had been trained in poetry, that was actually output in poetry. And the model was in English. So the goal of this project was to actually make a model in Spanish. Because there was none, and it was it's interesting once you, maybe not now, but at that time, when you would see what models, natural language processing models were available, you could actually, in some way reflected this hegemony, no? So it didn't reflect how much people, the actual number of people speaking the languages, but the power that these human groups had. I hope I'm making myself clear, no? So there was none in Spanish. So in a way, this was a contribution, no? Sort of a scientific aspect. So we trained this model, and it was... Oh, okay, so what should I do, you want me? Okay, so probably half of my talk will be gone. But I guess it depends on... But yes, so actually, this was quite interesting. This is a text from Jorge Eduardo Ailson. Oh, strange little change, you can't really say. It's called A Horrifying Sculpture. So it's actually, it's a poetic text in which he gives instructions how to make this doll. And this doll, he describes, again, this is from the 60s, early 70s. And he talks about this doll that would be fed with the most important text of humanity, and then she would output poems, and then she would explode. So the work does reference this series of works, no? So this is the structure of Ailson. So it comes with two models. First, the GPT-2, which is, maybe you've heard of GPT-3, that is most perfect natural language processing model, blah. So it's called a generative pre-trained transformer. And then, this was mainly fed with this poetry in Spanish, and then fine-tuned with this Cecilia Vicuña, plus Ailson, plus my own poetry. And then these texts were fed to this couple that worked together, the Wave Glow System and the Tacatron, eventually changing with the SPNet. And then that's the part that made the actual speech, no? Now, the thing is that I actually intentionally kept all glitches and errors, because my question was like, do these errors actually make this synthetic voice sound more familiar? Of course, I didn't do like a study, but when I asked people, actually, that was the most uncomfortable part, because it actually sounded like an old recording. So basically what I was doing I was using a different set of biases, no? So this is some of the questions that I was, and that I linked to this talk. This question will be interesting. I don't know if I will be able to talk about it now but basically the question is, or the idea is, to rethink dominant aesthetics. Again, this is a modern quipu. This is from the town of Tupicocha, and as you can see, the knots are a very important part of the structure, and that's how the calling system works. This is an actual quipu. And depending on where you put the knot and how many turns the knot has, it has a value. I've been working this for with this structure quite many years, and which was no. Okay. That's what I get out of using a computer that is not mine. Yeah. Oh. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, it's fine. So, I mean, probably you've... it's quite a trend by now. Many artists, particularly female artists, are working with textile technologies presented as such. Basically, because they relate to these subjects, they are connected to I mean, nowadays they are openly connecting it to feminism, and also trying to sort of recognizing the origins of computers related to textile technologies, basically. Again, probably you know about this, so I won't talk much about this. And yeah, at least my personal goal is to subvert this established preconception related to the history of textiles. And then again, yeah, but it is no time anyways, I guess. Yeah, but it's, I mean, it was going to be videos of my performances, but there's no time to see that, but maybe you can go to one of my performances and see. So, yeah, I mean, tomorrow you'll see what you would like to. Well, I didn't know this. You see, like, I didn't use my computer because it wasn't an adapter. So I just used this computer. This is new to me, but yeah, I didn't know that you needed to actual access for video. It's strange because you could play the other video as well. I don't know. But yes, this is something that also probably you're familiar with. You know, Ada Lovelace and being considered the first programmer, and then the punch cards as first memories, you know, related to the Jacquard loom. And then again, we go to first painted work by an artist. Her name is Elena Isque. She's a Peruvian artist. This was painted in 1921. And that's why I said that actually the reference, the Skipu reference is like 100 years old. Well, actually a bit more by now. Because this is the first time at least that I consider that like a Kipu was represented within an artistic framework, no? This is an example of Eielson's work with the Kipu, and particularly the knot. This work is it's a Peruvian artist called Teresa Burga. It's quite interesting because she also refers, I mean, it's called, it's related to, it's like a way, I mean, it's actually data visualization. This is from the 1980. And she did this yes, data visualization related to the different roles and the situation of women in Peru. So she did this color codes to represent this data. So it's analog data visualization, let's say, using referencing the Kipu. This is a Sheila Hicks piece, and if there's time, I can talk about this later. Cecilia Vicuña's work. This is my own work with Patricia Cadavid. And this is what you would see basically tomorrow. So about tomorrow, well, the system that I will use, actually it's, you know, a part of it is using machine learning applied to computer vision. So I trained this JOLA 5 network to be able to recognize knots. So what I do in the performance is I start tying knots, and depending where I tie them, they are linked to a line of code in a Foxdot. So I'm actually doing live coding with the Kipu structure. So this is an interesting site from Duke Hui, which is quite a popular philosopher by now, maybe. And he talks about the role, basically, of of the legacy of these big cultures from the Americas, but linked to indigenous thought as well. No, now of course, indigenous thought, just to call it like this, is a simplification, because yeah, depends on the cultural group. But I think in general, I think this is a line, not only my work, but many of the works that I've represented, sort of putting into value this type of thought because of the connection the connection that these groups have with the land, with Earth, no? And it's especially important in these times of ecological crisis. So the question was, how can we think about the mental framework or the knowledge from these groups nowadays? And I wanted to show this, you can say this is much a picture, you probably know it, but the idea, I think it was important for me to sort of, think it from an architectonic perspective, in the sense that there's a change of paradigm just in this architecture, because I would say that usually the land is modified to human needs, right? Architecture is not usually, maybe nowadays it's been questioned, but it's not usually thought to adapt to nature. Nature is adapted to human architecture. But in this other mental framework, it's the other way around, right? Architecture is adapted to nature, even if this is quite costly work-wise. But yes, this is an example of it, that it's quite aesthetically pleasing. But it's also anti-seismic. These structures have survived all throughout the years because of being thought this way. So I thought it was an interesting way to sort of think about how we can rethink technology beyond the human. This might be, this is more related to actual art and this history that I was referring to before, and how this history has been maybe, well, nowadays it's more talked about, but for many years it has been denied or not recognized, the influence of different cultural and aesthetic traditions that has had in modern Western art. And again, this has to do more with how this thought and aesthetic, thought system and aesthetic consideration has been appropriated by modern and later on, speak like contemporary art, and this really is, I won't go with it, you can read it fast, but it sort of shares this story in how the knowledge of these other aesthetics reached Europe. And this is sort of the main story being told. But actually, and as you can see, that Annie Albers, she was quite open about her interest in Andean and Latin American art. But again, this has to do more with my work with textiles, in the sense that in this process of appropriation, certain voices are silenced, of course, because they don't, either they are not of interest of the artist or they can't really be understood entirely, because most of these artists were interested in the aesthetics, even if they were interested in the culture. But the thing is that actually, Elena Iscue, this artist that did the quipu that you saw before in aquarelle, This was actually sort of like a plan of the Peruvian government. She was sent by the Peruvian, from the Peruvian, I mean, the Peruvian government financed her in order to go to Europe to make a Peruvian Andean art known. So again, I'm interested in this story because her name was forgotten, but the influence reached. Nevertheless, it wasn't completely acknowledged. So that's quite an interesting process, how the hegemony kind of absorbs this, but the history, the way that it's being told, doesn't really acknowledge these processes, no? And this is something quite interesting, again, related to the quipu. And how am I with time? Should I? Are you still? 10 minutes, okay. And this is something quite interesting, again, that has to do with appropriation in art. I'm not saying that all appropriation is bad or it shouldn't be done. I'm just interested in these structures behind it, no? So Sheila Hicks, as you saw before, she's one of these artists that was interested in the 50s in Andean and, you know, Latin American, basically pre-Columbian art. And she is quite known. She has beautiful works. But again, this has to do more with economic structures and the market itself and how it reaffirms itself, and institutions also reaffirm themselves. So this is quite interesting. This piece is owned by the Tate. But it was bought, used funds that were meant to buy Latin American art. So the fact that she was referencing pre-Columbian art was enough enough reason for them to actually use these funds to buy the art of a U.S. artist, a North American artist, instead of buying art of a Latin American artist, no? And this is another case, it's very recent. Her name is Daris Rubio. She's a Mexican artist from Hidalgo. She is an indigenous artist that has been working with electronic art as well. She did this piece in 2015. This is a huipil, which is a traditional clothing from where she is from. She used a lily pad Arduino. And the idea is what to do this system that depending on the heartbeat of the user, in this case a female, if she felt threatened, if the heartbeat was beating too fast, then lights and sound would start playing, not sort of a protection system, and then it would communicate with another huipil and do this sort of protective communal system. And then, but then again, this is the work of Dora Bartilotti. She has, she tried her work in 2015, and apparently she got inspired by this work. And she did her own series of works that also has to do with security related to women, this time more connected to urban areas. And also it's a quite a similar work that also reacts depending on the stress of the person, on the wearer. And in this case, she uses voice. So why am I talking about this? The thing is now that is Rubio wants to be acknowledged, you know, because Dora Bartilotti has won first the C4's Electronica, and recently she was honorary mentioned in Ars Electronica as well with this piece. And since Daris lives in a small province, like in a sort of isolated province in Mexico, no one really knows. I mean, her voice can't be heard beyond actual Mexican borders. And this is quite an important case right now in Mexico that also reflects this structure. And so my question with this was, these are other artists that are currently working with the quipu as well. And again, this is connected with the performance tomorrow because, as I said, the question is like how us artists need to reformulate the reference to, with the, you know, when we're referencing the quipus, when we become aware that actually they're being used by communities right now. It's true, there's a, this, like each of us artists, because by now I present it as a movement, no? I'm not only one reference in this pre-Columbian device, it's been many, and there are many coming as well. So the question is, how are we going to deal with this fact that we are talking not about this dead artifact from the past, but something that it's a device that's being used currently, say, in the town of Topicocha, no? For example, in Peru, which is being, you know, this is an example of the ceremony of the Huayrona, and they currently use it as part of the ceremony. And I can explain a bit. These Ayus are big family groups, and each one of them has the quipu symbol of the family group. So in the ceremony, they wear it when they're passing, let's say. It's a civic ceremony. So regarding this, I wrote a manifesto. Again, you will be able to the performance is related to this manifesto as well. So while I perform, you'll be able to read it. And I don't want to talk much about it because the context, the content is complex, but at the same time, it's related with what I talked right now. So finally, the question is like, Alex McGlynn said something that really, I think it's an interesting way to end this talk and also to refer to my work, you know? Glitching pattern, how the glitch actually allows us to see the structure of the system or of the pattern itself, no? I'm just ending with these images of the corrupted structure series, which are really traditional patterns found in textiles that are distorted with sounds of different either voices or problematics related to where these textile traditions come from. This probably will be enough for another talk, but I just wanted to end this as an example with this like disruption of patterns given. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Let's see if we can see it. But I think it's in her account. She.
Catherine.
I'll do it with my phone. Maybe.
Era para tentarmos ver um dos vídeos.
Mas estava aqui.
Sim. Can you just
put maybe you need to pass the. That's so weird.
See if she can do it.
Maybe it's like. Me having to authorize bird?
Probably.
So weird, no?
In which slide is it? It's this
one. Oh.
Yeah?
Yeah? Does it work?
The sound is weird.
You see?
No, ask us.
Yes, just ask for me and then I'll approve it.
Yeah, you need to. I requested.
So strange. So if you have some questions, maybe you can ask them while I solve this technical. Okay. Where the heck? Okay, I never do that again. Then I know this. Look, it's not
maybe
really
it's in the
email. Maybe.
Yeah.
But I mean, we can find it online as well, huh?
Do you want me to Google it? Yeah, it's this one.
There.
Be sure that it worked.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you saw a bit in the ILSON video, anyways. So. This is quite old, actually.
It doesn't matter. You get to see some
work. Yeah, I just put.
What?
I already authorized you those. But this is in, yeah.
What, but.
Yeah, the thing is with this is that, yeah. So the thing is that, I mean, it was, yeah, it was really small. Yeah, it was really small. It wasn't supposed to, it was supposed, but I can show you another one if you want. Okay, I can, okay.
Have you got anything at the Kimberley
for us? If you want me to show that, no,
yeah,
surprise.
That's what we want.
Well, this is something, yeah. I can show you now.
You need to pass your
look
Cambridge
at this ridiculousness.
Exam. Don't panic.
That's
try
what you get.
There you can find a teacher that is a perfect match for you.
Okay, this is an example of the this textile controllers that I.
What about the sound?
You know, it's just like it's like a pro video, so I can just. So when, this is one of the quipos. It's not. I mean, I'll play it as well tomorrow, but this is another performance with these textile controllers that I've been developing over the years. So this one actually worked with samples, but the samples are actually taken from this Baroque style composition from the 1600s, which I found really interesting because it was composed by a Spanish priest that actually came to what now is Peru. To teach the Catholic faith, but he learned Quechua, which was the native, it's the main native language from the Andean area, he actually in this voice, this polyphonic piece, he references Andean symbols, and talks about the Virgin Mary as the weaver, and all of this is being sung in Quechua. So I use samples of this word being sung by a Peruvian singer that is part of the national choir, and that's what you. So actually, what this device does is reinterprets this piece. Now this big artwork. It's curious because I can play it live, but I also show it in art shows. So depending on the context, it actually changes function. Depending on the layer that you touch, it either speaks in Spanish or in Quechua. So the first layer actually says, sí, señor, sí, señora, sí, señorita, because it's the actual voice from an immigrant from the Andes to the city that works as a cleaning lady. But the more that you put your hand inside, you actually start hearing her speaking Quechua. She shares the experience of how she was mocked of speaking this language in the city. And how she has started forgetting it, even if it was her mother tongue. So again, yeah, as you can see, this is a Raspberry Pi. These are textile controllers. But I'm quite interested to know how the performance itself, like sound, the sound changes once the devices are different. Once it's not a computer or a keyboard that you're using, but other type of like softer materials. Also how you play them differently because of how they are designed and what the material is made of. I'll just put it a week. Maybe this is more interesting. No, you want to see the one that I will use in the bar? Yeah, yeah. So this one, yeah, this is as well the lily pad that you could see in the works of Dalí as well, and it's pretty popular. And I thought to leave it exposed because it was kind of a way to honor women in tech, as this was designed by a woman thinking about how to, you know, develop technology for textiles. I embroidered this myself, and it references this community in the Peruvian Amazonia, which is called, well, they are called the Chipibo Conibo. It's not really the same. I did an interpretation of this. And the voice that you hear is the voice of Aristela Brito. I work with her for this project and with others. She's from the community. She is a singer. And the interesting thing is that the Chipibo Conibo say that they can actually sing their patterns. So some researchers have presented it as a type of notation system, like a visual notation system. Others say that it's not true, that actually it's a kind of a way to trick tourists to sell more textiles. In my own research, what I've discovered is that they actually are singing the myth related to the actual design, because each of these designs have a name. They have a tradition and behind why the designs are like that. They're probably related to a fish or to a toad. And then the myth behind it is what it's being sung. That's what I found in my own research. So there is a connection, but maybe not in the way that we think musical notation is. And then it turns pretty. The other one? Yeah, you're going to see like. You want to see it. The thing is, then it ends up in noise. I use this textile, which I've turned kind of like a potentiometer. And then all of these harmonies end up in noise, depending if I stretch it or not. So yeah, let's see if I find it. Yeah. This kind of what you, kind of, I mean, because this was meant for an online performance. But the system is the same, just maybe the configuration will be a bit different. Maybe there's no volume. And the text is, you'll be able to read it properly tomorrow. For example, Alex McLean has worked on the Kipu as well. Basically that's why we know each other. In this bigger. Should I? So in this research that I haven't talked much about it because of time constraints and maybe it's a bit deviating for the subject, but I mentioned them a bit. It's like quite many artists that by now we're referencing this pre-Columbian, of origin, pre-Columbian device. And that's why, after talking with them, we introduced to each other, I did one meeting and probably, hopefully, there will be more. To sort of discuss this, what was the correct way to reference these devices once we are aware that they don't belong strictly to the past, but to a certain point could be seen as cultural appropriation. As it could be because, of course, it's a spectrum, no? I still don't know how much, I mean, it's, say, me as a Peruvian, am I appropriating, am I reappropriating? How much is my right? When does my indigenous past end? How Western am I? It really depends a lot in the context. Probably in Sweden, I'm completely considered non-Western person, being here, not like this, so it's quite a complex. Subject. I don't have the answers. No, I'm just basically presenting these problematics and then again generating this other set of biases, but in an explicit and conscious way. And thank you for the invitation. I hope I didn't bother you. Bored you.
Well, thank you for your presentation.
Because
of the light. Yeah, I just have a simple question. Could you give us a sense of what is traditionally represented or encoded, I don't know if it's a proper word, in a kipu,
and
how it is used socially, I mean, to make a connection with the tradition.
Yes, of course, like, I'm used to the word tradition in a sort of very broad way. When I use tradition in this context, I refer to indigenous cultural traditions from Latin America. Because of course tradition can be referred to many things, no? And this, you know, depending on the context and whether one is referring to, can have different values as well, no? And again, that's a problem with tradition. But yes, the kipu is this, as you saw, you know, it consists of a main court with cords pending or hanging from this main one. And depending on where you put them, now I need to say that the ones that we usually refer to, maybe not Sheila Hicks, but most of us, follows the structure of the Inca kipu. But the Inca kipu is not the only type of kipu that existed in pre-Columbian times. There was also a style of kipu that was before that, from the Wari culture, that was way more colorful, it didn't depend that much on the knot, but more on the colors that was used. So the code, in that sense, had to do with
you know, a combination between the threads that wrapped these hanging cords and the knots. Now, the thing is that, there has been found quipus without knots, and the idea is that this, some artists link it to, they call it the pre-Columbian computer. I am a bit critical. I think that can be a bit misleading because it's more like a memory. It's more like a read and write memory. I mean, it wasn't used to do mathematical operations. You would do the mathematical operations on another device. It was made of stone called the Jupana. And then this would be annotated in the quipu. And say, for example, if some of these, if you were at doing a census of people and then something changed, you would untie the one of these knots, one or many, so the Yupana. It's like a, So if presented like that, it would be somewhat like an analog computer, you know? But if you refer just to a quipu, it's more like a read and write memory, really. So you would, and it said, you know, and then there's like some researchers that said that it was a writing system. But then again, this is a bit controversial because these researchers actually see it in a very Western way of what writing is. So probably it could be presented more like an inscription system, no? And then what could be annotated in that way? That's another, because we know the system and how to decode the numerical values. That is, you know, I can explain to you, like the lower knots are, depending on the turns, and it's all decimal based. So depending on the turns, it would be, like units. So it would be like this, no? Not here, units, here, tens, hundreds, thousands. And they would go up from the lower part of the hanging threads or cords, go upwards. So that has been decoded. The thing is that there are some quipus that don't follow that structure, and those are the ones that are hypothesized to have another type of information stored. So I guess this sort of relation to code and this sort of lost language is what has captivated us artists for such a long time, no? And that's why it has clicked with so many artists that are working within computational formats.
Hi, thank you. So your talk had me think about Sadie Plant's book, Zeros and Ones, and she rewrites the history of technology as it relates to fabric and textiles. And she talks a lot about this idea of collective authorship or anonymous authorship. And so in thinking about the AIELSEN project, I wonder, I just wanted to hear you speak a little bit more about the authorship of that. I understand it's a collaboration with a machine, but is there a collaboration with Jorge Eduardo AIELSEN? And you also mentioned that there was some sort of controversy with the use of AIELSEN's voice. I just would love to hear a little bit more.
Yes, of course I had to ask permission because even if the recordings weren't given to me, like I gathered them, you know, they were online, seeing YouTube, some of them, no? That's where the controversy lays, no? Because when you use this speech synthesis system and you're using the voice of someone else, since they can replicate it almost identically, then, you know, especially can be problematic with a person that has passed away and cannot give consent. But I was also interested in the limits of voice and, accent as well, since he spoke like a Peruvian, but in a very situated way because he was from Lima. So his accent was different, say, from someone who lived in the Andes. But the interesting thing, and this is something that we can't really pick up just by hearing it, is that the bass, I mean, it was fine-tuned on Jorge Eduardo Eielson's voice, but the biggest data set was actually from an Argentinian data set available, which is the AL Labs, which is quite broad, because since we had to train it from scratch, the snippet, you know, it had just 20 minutes of Eielson's voice. So first, the whole system was trained from scratch with this big data set that is basically taken from audiobooks, and then it was fine-tuned on Eielson. So it's not really 100% his voice. It's also a compendium of his other voices, no? And I think that's something that also replicates in the actual text production. So yes, I mean, I think I'm quite explicit in this sort of collaborative production. So it's not, I present the Eielson as an entity, you know, on its own creating poetry, no? It is part of many Hispanic artists. So, well, poets, but well, not only poets, but yeah. So maybe that. Yes. Thank you.